So who does this Syrian president sound like?
You can forge anything these days. And we're living in a fake news era, as you know. Everybody knows this.
Bashar al-Assad dismissing the latest accusations of military atrocities in his country in a statement to Yahoo News, such as the use of chlorine gas.
One of the most horrific things about this weapon is that it tends to affect the most vulnerable the most. So children, for example, they are lower, so the concentration of the gas is highest, just above the ground. They don't know that they're not supposed to breathe in this gas. And so we've seen many, many children among the injured and among the killed in Aleppo.
That's Ulla Solvang, Deputy Director for Emergencies at Human Rights Watch. Its latest report documents 8 occasions between November 17th and December 13th, 2016, during the final months of the battle for the city of Aleppo, where poisonous chlorine gas was used. Solvang of Human Rights Watch is with me to discuss the latest revelations on the Syrian conflict and what civilians are facing right now.
The Syrian conflict has now been going on for 6 years, and it has shown very little signs of abating. The violence is going in waves, but the violence there in the last few months has been as horrific and as intense as we've ever seen before. So we now believe that in these 6 years, up to perhaps 500,000 people might have been killed in this conflict. Millions of people have been displaced. Maybe 5 million people have had to flee the country and seek refuge in other countries. So this is a major ongoing crisis still.
What would you say about the Amnesty International report that more than 10,000 people have been hung in a Syrian jail where these secret executions are taking place?
I myself was part of a project where we identify 27 sort of underground secret detention facilities where there was massive use of torture, the most horrific methods. We have also documented that thousands of people have been killed. You might remember the Caesar photos where a defector had taken photos of almost 7,000 people who had been killed in detention in the course of a few years.
The use of barrel bombs and other, anti-personnel weapons is basically the best way of describing them. They kill civilians. That's the intent. Has been well known in Syria throughout the conflict. What about the use of chemical weapons?
So this is the topic of a report that Human Rights Watch released just yesterday. And what we found was that Syrian government forces, helicopters, in the last few weeks of the battle for Aleppo that ended last year, so in November and December, repeatedly dropped chlorine bombs on civilians on populated areas in Aleppo. And there are several problems with it. One is that chlorine is a chemical. So when you inhale it, it reacts with the mucous membranes in your lungs and it creates fluids. So you basically end up drowning, you suffocate. And we documented 8 such attacks with chlorine. And more than 200 people, civilians, had to seek hospital treatment for the effect. 9 people were killed, including 4 children.
And of course, this is a very primitive weapon. I mean, it takes no sophistication whatsoever to create a chlorine bomb. And chlorine is as available as, Clorox in the department store. It's just a higher concentration.
It is a higher concentration, and it has many legitimate civilian uses as well. So when the Syrian government in 2013 was forced to give up its chemical weapons program because it had launched an incredibly deadly chemical weapons attack, it wasn't forced to give up all its chlorine because you use it for water purification, you use it for, as you said, cleaning, etc. But it's still illegal under the Chemical Weapons Convention to use chlorine as a weapon, to use any chemical as a weapon, and that's what we're seeing. And what we're really concerned about is that the Chemical Weapons Convention is one of the international bans on weapons with the most consensus. 192 governments, states have agreed that chemical weapons should never be used. And when you see that Syria is repeatedly using chemicals with full impunity, then we're concerned that that undermines that very important norm. So we're calling on the Security Council, and of course, including the United States, to take strong action and to impose sanctions on those who are responsible for the use of these horrific weapons.
Ula Silvang, Deputy Director for Emergencies at Human Rights Watch. We've got a new U.S. administration. We've got the Russians and the Syrian regime declaring some form of victory and a return to peace in Aleppo, where the evacuations took place and the hostilities have apparently ceased. What does this report say about those statements and what the international community, and you've already outlined this a little bit, but what the international community is even capable of doing now?
After the fall of Aleppo, the violence has been significantly reduced, but it's not gone. There is still aerial bombardment in certain areas of Syria. The violence is still continuing. We still see the use of cluster munitions, for example, and other nasty weapons. And we still see the use of chemical weapons in other places of Syria, the same type of chlorine attacks. So I think it is really important to remember that the war in Syria is not over. And we are concerned that we might see the same kind of dynamic as we saw in Aleppo in other urban centers in sort of the Damascus suburbs of Ghouta, for example, or in Idlib, where the government might consider using the same tactics. I think one of the most disturbing findings from our investigation of the chlorine attacks in Aleppo was that we saw that it had become an integral part of the government's military strategy. We saw that the chlorine attacks were closely following and targeting areas where government ground troops wanted to advance. And that is a real worry, that we're seeing this being used in such a systematic way. So I think what is really important, you know, for any peace talks and for any ceasefire as well, is that there is some sort of accountability for some of the horrific crimes that have committed by all sides. Without that, I'm really concerned that any peace talks might be very fragile.
Ula Silvang is Deputy Director for Emergencies at Human Rights Watch. He spoke to us from Paris. Ula, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Martin Chulov covers the Middle East for The Guardian, and he's been watching carefully the latest humanitarian atrocities in Syria, but notes the policy twists are just as surprising, even as possible peace talks, which began in Kazakhstan, may actually be successful. Martin, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's good to be with you.
What is the scenario that's going to move this conflict in any way positively or negatively? And I can only see negative at this point.
Well, for the first time in 6 years, we actually do have somewhat of a momentum on a diplomatic front. And I say momentum in a qualified sense. What we do have is Russia and Turkey, Russia being a key broker of the Syrian regime and Turkey being a key broker of the Syrian opposition up until the last year, have been putting their heads together to try and come up with some kind of a plan which is going to align opposition groups with the Syrian regime through a negotiated diplomatic process. We saw the start of that in Astana a month ago, and we are expecting there to be some movement towards a follow-up process under UN auspices in Geneva within a month or so. But on the diplomatic front, while things may be moving, there is it's taking a long time to get actual traction on the fighting fields of Syria, where the battle has ground this country down into almost rubble from north to south and east to west.
So it looked like a pretty explosive beginning to the talks in Kazakhstan. You believe have managed to hold themselves together without any role of the United States and are headed to a much different and possibly much more substantive second round in Geneva.
I think substantive is the operative word. These talks actually do have both parties genuinely interested, particularly the Syrian regime, and they do have a key backer on both sides underpinning them. Now, Russia is doing all it can to try and bring about a solution to this after bombing the opposition to the negotiating table over the last 15 months. I think there has been an implicit recognition made, certainly in northern Syria, by the opposition that this fight is something they cannot win now that their backers, Turkey, Qatar and Saudi, are not as robust in their support as they were. The Russian calculation is that they want to be able to bring some kind of a solution to the most intractable crisis of modern times. And they also want to see off Syria's other main backer, Iran, who was trying to shape what emerges from the ruins of Syria in its own likeness. So there's very much competing visions going forward there.
Martin, I know this is the kind of thing that entertainment is the wrong word, but certainly the irony here doesn't escape you. Comment on the irony that a NATO member, Turkey, would be working with Russia to create an extended safe zone on the ground in Syria with U.S. approval, if not actual assistance.
Yeah, it sounds like a riddle, doesn't it? It really does. The shifting sands of allegiance and alliance over the last couple of years have been baffling to even those who cover this full time, so it must be very difficult for listeners to comprehend. But the Turks have been the pivotal force in this equation, and they were very much on side with the Syrian opposition. They had done a lot of arming the Islamist groups, not ISIS, but Ahrar al-Sham, who's aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, and some of the other more mainstream Free Syria Army groups. But early last year, they changed. In late 2015, they had a border dispute with the Russians. They shot down a Russian plane, and there were 6 months of tensions after that. The Russians then went to President Erdogan and said, "We support the notion of Syria's territorial integrity." Now, that was important because what that meant for the Turks was that the Kurds, who were on the move in the northeast, were not going to be supported in their efforts to change the colour of the Turkish border. There was a gap of about 60 miles that the Kurds were trying to move into, and if they got there, that would mean that there were Kurds along the whole 800-mile presence. The Russians acknowledged, they recognised that this was something which was far more existential in Turkey's eyes than anything else, and they decided to support Turkey's ambitions to keep the Kurds away. The price to pay for that was that Erdogan walked away from Aleppo, and he positioned himself not anymore as a someone supporting a military force, but somebody supporting a humanitarian situation. So he was therefore prepared to do Russia's bidding, and we find ourselves in this peculiar situation that you described.
So the Kurds are the wild card that produce a hand that deals Turkey as the peacemaker and Russia as the backer of what might take place in Geneva. That's the takeaway here.
Absolutely. Yep, that's what took place.
Wow. That's a scenario that no one would have expected 2 years ago.
No, but it's always been obvious that out of all of this, the Kurds were going to be the wild card as far as Turkey was concerned. I mean, you have these two competing forces, enemies. You have ISIS, the Islamic State, who used Turkey's borders to cross into Iraq and Syria, and then have used Turkey's borders to get back and wreak carnage. But the whole time that's been taking place, Turkey's had its eyes on the Kurds as far more significant a threat. And the reason being, they believe that the Kurds of northeastern Syria are one and the same as the Kurds of southeastern Turkey, who have been fighting a four-decade insurgency, at times a separatist insurgency, with Turkey.
Martin Chulov covers the Middle East for The Guardian. Thank you so much, Martin.
You're very welcome.